Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's Irate Debate and Calamitous Commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Today's episode, Themes in World War II Propaganda. Does Uncle Sam want you? I'm your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm River.
I'm Bruce. And that'd be a good title to put on a poster.
What are you talking about? There are posters with that everywhere.
Oh, that's what those are.
I thought we just got a wallpaper, finally.
Propaganda.
Propaganda.
Specifically World War II propaganda.
Indeed.
Considered by some the first war where propaganda played a major factor in the victory and defeat of nations.
I feel in a sense it might also really be the last.
It kind of depends on how you look at it. The Cold War also had a lot of propaganda going.
We got a lot more creative with the propaganda in the Cold War, though. Propaganda in the Cold War was much harder to tell from just normal stuff. I mean, there's the story about the CIA paying for the production of Dr. Zhivago to be published all over the Russian front so that ostensibly people would go like, oh, we live in terrible conditions, let's side against our government. Stuff like that was a much more subtle kind of propaganda that came about with the Cold War. World War II's propaganda was right in your face. It was very clearly propaganda.
In a larger sense, World War II is, I feel like it's the last time when all of society was on the same page. Everyone thought this was the right thing to do. Later on, Cold War, a lot of the propaganda gave rise to the counterculture, sort of divided us, but everyone was in on everything in World War II.
Unless you're Switzerland or Sweden, but, you know.
Yeah, well, they were all together in their opinion, whatever it may be.
Which is, we don't want in.
Yeah. But I'm thinking about how, you know, pretty much every military age male, if they could, signed up. Can you imagine all of society pitching in for a war the way they did then?
Well, and to a large extent, some of that was the feeling that they were the defenders of the homeland, right? There's the early part of World War II when the U.S. was involved, but a little bit more trepidatious, and then Pearl Harbor happens, and it feels like we got hit at home. And suddenly, that nationalistic spirit, that desire to protect your homeland, becomes a major factor. But we see throughout that process of molding how people would look at the war, these themes of heroism come up over and over again. We see themes of pride in nationalism, of a journey, of sacrificing for the greater good.
Oh, absolutely. And it didn't necessarily just happen in the United States, too. It happened pretty much with every major power of the Second World War. Germany had it, Japan had it, Britain had it, the Soviet Union certainly had it. They are considered some of the best propagandists of that conflict, even before and after. They churned out propaganda like nothing else, and so did we.
For Britain and the Soviet Union, this was very much an existential crisis.
Well, the war was on their borders. I mean, it was right there in their backyard, and they had already seen at one point what had happened to some of the smaller countries in the neighborhood that had not fallen in line with Hitler's plans for things. And, I mean, the invasion of Poland comes to mind right off the bat. You know, Poland at the time, while it had a pretty decent populace, did not have a very strong military. They mobilized local militias and smaller group fights to try and hold back the German invasion. But inevitably, they were just crushed under that particular boot heel. And I think after seeing a few of those, not just Poland, but some of the other smaller neighbors fall to that robust a military force, that it was definitely time for the Brits and the Russians to really go like, whoa, wait a minute. is Hitler big enough to just come and do that to us too?
Although, to be fair, in the tragedy of losing one's homeland, that there again was an opportunity for propaganda for the Polish in exile. It was the Battle of Wisna, the Polish Thermopylae, in which a small handful of Polish troops basically stayed behind to defend their borders from this unrelenting machine. They lost, and Poland was invaded, but it was a very galvanizing force for everybody that got out, especially the Polish Air Force in exile, who ended up going on to fight in the Battle of Britain and various other conflicts on the side of the Allies. They became an inspiration. Churchill used it to help rally Britain in a time that seemed most dark for them. He said so himself, never has so much been owed to so few in the history of the Empire. Churchill was great at spinning these struggles into nigh-heroic epics.
He was almost a kind of propagandist in his own right. I mean, to some degree, his ability to turn a phrase that really captured the spirit of a moment in a particular way was a way to reassure people in his own homeland, you know, to say, it's all right, we're the British, we can fucking handle this, you know. By being a little flippant with this very dire situation, it was like, hey, don't worry, the guys at the top aren't worried. You shouldn't be either. Just keep doing what you're doing. And in some ways, it was a big finger to the Third Reich. It was like, you can't, we're inflappable. You can't scare us with this. And even though the reality of the bombings and the terrible things that were happening to Britain as a country, not showing any fear at the top levels was almost a way to send another message to all the onlookers, be they ally or enemy.
Oh, absolutely. Even though we know in retrospect that the High Command didn't know if the Blitz, the Battle of Britain, would end up with the entire island being destroyed, they put on this very strong face. At the time, they seemed nigh inflappable.
It was a good choice. I mean, the only way is to behave as if you are inflappable, or the only chance is to behave as if you are inflappable, therefore that is what you project. But that is the difference of propaganda to your own people, you know, the stiff upper lip and taking pride in that under horrible circumstances and situations. But, you know, for the British, it's entirely explanatory why everyone would be so cohesive in opinion, because they were facing down destruction. I find it interesting that America, we were all so marching in lockstep as a society in a way that we've never been since or probably before.
And that's the thing, too, in both Britain and the U.S. in the lead-up to the Second World War, actually had a lot of supporters of Germany and National Socialism. Like, this doesn't get talked about much, but there were people, especially prominent people, who received death threats for criticizing Germany because of organizations like the German-American Bund and people of that, like, because there was this support for what Germany was doing, and propaganda in the United States and in Britain really helped make that the unpopular opinion. By providing this sort of image to get behind, they made it very much the unpopular opinion, made it very easy for them to get on with the war, basically.
Well, and we've got two kinds of propaganda to discuss in some sense. One of them is propaganda based on what was really going on, telling the heroic story, telling the story of the people from your nation who are sacrificing or fighting or winning or whatever the circumstances were. And that's interesting, but the long and short of it is that it's history. There are a lot of places to hear about it, there's a lot of stuff to tell, and more than enough time has been dedicated in this world to telling the stories of World War II. I think the stories we're really here to discuss more thoroughly, though, are the ones that maybe didn't happen. The stories that are as much fiction as they are truth, and how that end of the propaganda machine, the creation, sometimes whole cloth, of epics and stories for us to rally around, and how that affected us as a nation and as individuals.
One great example, as River just mentioned, that, you know, prior to America's entry into World War II, whether you liked fascism or not was, you know, as controversial, split as opinion as we've ever had about anything. But we've so rapidly turned that into everyone is completely against it that we almost forgot that that a lot of people thought Nazis were cool right up until then. Henry Ford wrote a lot about that stuff. IBM was working with them. There's, you know, they were marching in the streets wearing German uniforms, and like I said, the Bund. I mean, it was actually as popular as, you know, most political opinions are in this country. And then all of a sudden, that's all gone. And after, you know, a couple few months, we forgot we ever had been that way.
Kind of getting to what Sean was saying, we see in this time of information and sometimes disinformation and things, the sort of rise of the national character, the representation. For us, it's, you know, Uncle Sam. For Britain, in some ways, it was, you know, Britannia, the Angel Britannia, amongst other various symbols, including the crown, of course. And there's this, you sort of see this buildup of these national giants, as it were. I mean, to for lack of a better term for it, these representations of a whole nation and culture basically duking it out with one another, you know, and that became strong imagery during that time.
And I think you've touched on something really interesting there. You almost have two subsets of these sort of representations that we use to define what the fight was to us, what the war was to us. You have the purely symbolic representations, like you mentioned, the crown, and for America it was the eagle, and several other highly symbolic and very stirring images that are not in and of themselves expected to be partaking of the battle. And then there are the personifications. There are the sort of characters that are actual people that, at least interpretations that we would have of the world as we go through the war, are actually seen depicted being there in the trenches doing the fighting. The Uncle Sam's out there actually, at least in political cartoons and the like, slugging Hitler in the jaw and the like. You know, it's a personified representation that we can follow along with in a way that the eagle can't be, right? The eagle can soar over the battlefield or can be seen as a symbolic gesture towards an American victorious stance, but it's not in the trenches holding the Tommy gun, whereas you can depict Uncle Sam doing things like that and actually being there with the boys fighting the war.
And there, of course, sort of the soldiers made myth and stuff like that. The concept of G.I. Joe comes from this. The sort of everyman who was willing to leave home and go fight for a noble cause. And this is where we see Captain America come from. You know, there are comics certainly featuring him and this sort of ragtag group of Americans that go to fight the Germans or the Japanese or, you know, our enemies at the time. And, of course, Superman, who was already an established comic book character at the time. A lot more nationalistic heroes in the framework of comic books to raise this national pride and to raise morale in the homeland.
There's a bit of an interesting exception that occurs during this period from the usual hero's journey, I think, and that is G.I. Joe and the Everyman, the glorification of the average hero. Not the exceptional hero like a Luke Skywalker or an Oedipus Rex, but the everyman, there are hundreds of thousands of them, they're all out there, they're joining up, but they're glorified in an exceptional way, even though they flat out openly admit that there is nothing exceptional about them, they're the average foot soldier, but the average foot soldier is great and should be glorified. I think it follows from the stuff that they've done with Unknown Soldier after World War I, sort of after the fact, honoring sacrifice of the forgotten. But yeah, that concept of the average guy is great, that we're making heroes of the foot soldier, that I think that's new, and I think it is a bit at odds with what we usually think of with the hero's journey, in which there's a chosen one.
Well, in some sense, we're coming back to this idea of the symbolic representative journey, right? The hero's journey is representative in that each of us identifies with the hero in some sense. We all want to be the special one, right? But the special one goes on the journey so that all the other people don't have to. The hero of the hero's journey is a stand-in for the rest of us. The problem is that if you're trying to mobilize a war effort, having a stand-in for the rest of us doesn't do you any good. You need to make the rest of us have to go on the journey ourselves. And so then you see, yeah, like you mentioned, G.I. Joe's rise. And I think that even contained within the name, right, G.I. stands for, depending on which historian you're listening to, either general issue or government issue Joe. The idea was that this was so, at least initially, obviously the later incarnations are different, but at least initially is so generic a character as to be literally anyone's father, son, uncle, whoever you knew personally who was off fighting the war.
And that's where we get to with some of the more subtle propaganda, this time especially in America and in Britain and in the Soviet Union, is the everybody pitching in. You know, we have characters like Rosie the Riveter and cartoon characters buy war bonds, buy less at the store, be willing to put up with rations because we are, all of us at the time, providing this towards this war effort. By rationing, we can make sure more supplies are going to our soldiers abroad. By buying war bonds, we can make sure that munitions are able to be bought. By kind of giving up of ourselves, we are becoming the maybe lesser heroes, but we are, you know, becoming heroes in our own way because we are willing to forego these sort of comforts to make sure that we have a more fit war machine.
Yeah, it's like an entire society focusing like a coherent laser instead of scattered light. Which is almost kind of ironic because the central philosophy of National Socialism and fascism in general was that Volk concept that the more unified a society is, the more it will defeat other societies in the competition between different races or societies, as it were. If you get your society more unified and everyone is on the same page and working together and working towards a common cause, they'll beat the other societies and win. And that's what we did. We played their own game of everyone working together on the same page to do this. It's a little bit ironic about that, because we don't really, you know, we're not really into that, but we were for that period.
Sure, the American iconoclast is sort of a image to be held in its own right. You know, we see ourselves as the ultimate individuals, and yet in this circumstance we found a way to come together and work as a collective whole in a lot of ways. What I think is interesting about that is the level of internalization that goes on in that process. You know, this sense that by wearing out the soles of my shoes to the extent that I have patched every inch of it with whatever was available to keep walking on the same ones so I didn't have to get new ones, I was actually fighting the war. And how that translated to the later half of the war and the internment camps for Japanese Americans. And while they're a very terrible moment in our history, most of the people at the internment camps turned themselves in, came willingly, at least initially, to say, this is the way that I am going to fight the war, by proving that I'm not with the enemy. By coming here, by doing what I've been asked to do by my side, I am showing that I'm a good American. And it was interesting how the internal and external view of that action was so different, right? People in the camps were viewed with suspicion from outside, but the people inside the camps saw themselves as being these stand-up Americans who said, if you're even slightly worried about us, we're going to take ourselves out of the way.
And I think that also touches on the other side of propaganda, and this is something that everybody did, nobody was an exception to it, is the fear-mongering aspect of propaganda. The enemies could be around every corner, loose lips sink ships, stuff like that. We certainly did it, especially in concerns to the Japanese more than anyone, who experienced really hard times, even compared to like German Americans, or even first generation German Americans who had come over. Like, they weren't being put in internment camps, even though the same logic that was applied to Japanese Americans could have been applied to them. And of course, Germany did it. Of course, Britain did it, although to something of a lesser scale, because they used it as more of a galvanizing force than anything to make this monolithic bad guy in which they needed to fight. And the Soviet Union certainly did it. I mean, they used that propaganda to basically commit war crimes on their POWs in captured cities. That's something that propaganda also has a really good effect, is making you want to hate someone for not being your cultural group.
I think one of my favorite pieces of propaganda along the lines of the fear-mongering thing we're talking about was actually an internal piece of propaganda intended for sailors during this time period. And it was a poster that showed a picture of a sailor in his blue and whites holding this beautiful young blonde girl around the shoulders headed out on the town. And the caption on it said, "She might be your gal, but she could be everyone's pal. Watch out for VD and sharing secrets." And it was this idea that, like, you should even be so concerned with your security that you should be watching out for the people you already think you're close to, in some sense. This internalization within the military structure of you have to constantly be afraid of the enemy because they are lurking around every corner and apparently in some vaginas.
Well, I mean, again, with the advance of technology between World Wars I and II, along with mechanized warfare and so forth, this is also the first war where information is as powerful a tool as it is, where you could, in World War I, if you wanted to get a spy who could find useful information, he'd have to infiltrate the officers' quarters of the other side. In World War II, you could ask the average sailor, he might know when his ship's leaving, he might know where it's going. You know, you can get information that would be militarily useful from the common soldier.
Well, not just that, but the democratization, I guess, of radio technology. Everybody had it in the First World War. It was a lot less common. You saw a lot more overground or underground lines being run for site-to-site communication. But in World War II, everything was over the radio. You had, later in the war, the radar. You had coded messages, both false and actual, being run back and forth. You also had a great tool for propaganda, either for or against.
So there's lots of ways that the average person could have information that could be useful to the other side. There's lots of ways that the average person could get information from one place to another. Information security is now just not a matter for officers, but for kind of everybody.
And we definitely saw an administration side of that with the creation of, like, OSS and various other organizations.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that espionage and the craft of the intelligence service was really forged in World War II. We had spies, we had information gathering operations before that, but it never looked anything like or was anywhere near to the scale that it became in World War II. I think that speaks volumes to the amount of value that information had in that conflict. And to some degree, now that we've gotten as far out from World War II as we have, and we've started to hear some of the stories about what was going on behind the scenes and to learn some of this, there's some very interesting things to get to there. But since it was largely secret, a lot of it doesn't impact the propaganda end of things. So I think that we could refocus a little bit and talk about how the average person perceived the information that they had, right? Because that was almost as important. It might be true that for the first time in World War II, a person could have information that was of value to the enemy and not even realize it. But it was also true that for the first time, we were internalizing the sense that we personally had to be responsible for the fate of the nation, and that we personally had to be concerned with information security, not because we were spies, but because we were told that we were constantly to be on the lookout for spies.
Yeah, And again, the average person's importance becomes inflated again. Anyone who's involved in any way is all of a sudden kind of the hero of the story.
Which is incredibly important if you need people to make huge sacrifices, like aluminum being diverted from manufactured goods into specifically the war effort. Aluminum was incredibly scarce in America during World War II because we diverted most of it to the building of airplane bodies and munitions and the like.
Oh, certainly. Several metals were actually copper. That's why, you know, occasionally, if you're very lucky, you'll find a steel penny from around that time, because copper had been rationed to such a point that we had to use a much more ubiquitous material like steel to stamp them out, basically, to make currency.
So here's a conjecture. How we get everyone to buy into being the center of their own heroic myth all at the same time, and this includes the Germans, everyone deciding to go to war. We're coming off a decade of horrible deprivation of the Depression, in which there's really no position for anyone in the economy or in society. The economy doesn't want you. You know, everybody's unemployed. They're drifting from place to place, getting by as they can. And somehow somebody, let's say starting with Hitler, but then with everybody else who's fighting against him, says, I have a great and grand and glorious destiny for you. You can help shape and change the world. Let's go do this. I think that's something that everybody, after a decade of being useless, glommed onto in a way that nobody has before or since. Throwing that out as a possibility. You know, the sense of despair coming off of the Depression and uselessness of, you know, there's no purpose to your life. Anyone who can give you purpose, you're really going to go for it. Now, all of a sudden, we've got a whole world of all these societies competing in which every single person in them sees themselves suddenly as a hero who's going to shape the world. It's totally untestable.
It is totally untestable, and I think there's something to be said there, though. I mean, the American psyche was certainly bruised and battered at that point in history. You know, we had been through a terrible decade in the 30s. We had certainly seen plenty of social upheaval from the 1900s through the 1930s, changes to the way that we worked, to the way that we lived. And to some degree, making room in our society through the war effort gave us the opportunity to come to be on a better footing with those situations. You know, we saw the rise of mechanical manufacturing, Ford's conveyor belt, various technologies that hadn't existed a generation before that allowed us to build things in new ways, but that also threatened the way that we understood our place in the world. Right? It was no longer, my father was a cobbler, so I learned to be a cobbler, so now I did this. Now you had to go out in the world and look for a place to be, as opposed to just taking the place that seemed naturally allowed for you in the world. I think that psychologically that put us in the right frame of mind to benefit from the war in a lot of cultural ways that we couldn't have otherwise.
You're absolutely right. I found that divorcing people from the products of their labor is a great way to get them to go to war.
Actually, that brings up kind of something interesting about the Soviet Union, specifically, is they had this really great plan to kind of take your average person and turn them into a hero. Vasily Zaitsev is probably the most notable example I can think of. This farmer who was just happened to be good with a rifle ends up in the sniper corps and has it out for German officers and records more kills of German officers throughout his career than damn near any other Soviet sniper. He is plastered everywhere as this person that others can aspire to be, as this hero of the Soviet Union, as they call him, which was actually a rank at the time, reserved for those they felt exemplified Bolshevik life and the iron will and constitution of the Soviet peoples. And there were several people who got this, and the propagandists for the Soviet Union went wild with their stories because they were these people that came from very modest backgrounds to achieve something great.
Yeah, it's a really brilliant idea because it's almost like, it kind of reminds me of like the way they played up these stories and they write them is so great. Almost reminds me of pulp Western novels, you know, that they wrote in the West in the 1800s of just these crazy, amazing people who had these great adventures. And I can just picture, you know, I'm some Russian conscript sitting in a bunker reading or having read to me the story of somebody else whose background and motivation for being here is exactly like mine, but he's a this fabulous, exciting hero who's having these wonderful adventures, and maybe I'm that too. Or at least, you know, I can buy into it. It's a great way to pick these examples, turn them into larger-than-life things, and then say, this guy's you.
Well, it certainly worked better than the commissariat.
Well, what didn't?
Well, I know that we're going to stick mostly to World War II, but to sort of stretch out the idea of the Soviet propagandists, the idea of diffusing the hero character into the common folk by elevating the farmers and the workers and whatnot to a higher level, I think that that concept actually ended up being a less effective means of propaganda than what we saw from the Allies during the war. What we see more prominently from the Allies is this idea of a hero who is a neutral mask, almost a mannequin, that you could stand in for. Someone who is out there doing the thing, shooting the sniper rifle, running the tank, making the heroic sacrifice, that you can project yourself onto, rather than being told you're a hero for doing the basic thing that you're doing at home anyway. And to a large extent, I think that that makes things like wearing out the soles of your shoes into a kind of a personal battle. It becomes a way that I feel like I am winning the war. I am actively out there killing Germans by wearing out my shoes, as opposed to the feeling that I am a hero for doing what I was doing anyway, which, while it feels good, while it seems like the kind of thing that you would want to hear if you are a person in a farming, agricultural, manufacturing type role, it also kind of means that everyone else is also a hero. Everybody else is also exactly the same kind of hero. It doesn't allow me the power fantasy of being the person, whereas the neutral masked hero does.
We did have some exceptional heroes in the West. Audie Murphy comes to mind, but they didn't take the forefront in the way that that neutral mask, of which you speak, G.I. Joe, did to us. And it's interesting, you can make somebody feel like they're being heroic for going to bed hungry tonight. The generation before them went to bed hungry, and the generation before them went to bed hungry, but nobody felt so good about it as they did during World War II.
Right, we were proud of our sacrifices. In a lot of ways, we took a kind of personal emphasis on that sacrifice. And rather than just feeling like you didn't have enough, now you didn't have enough because you gave it up for the cause.
Well, and I think actually, I agree with you. I definitely feel that worked better in the American audience, the individual hero, the everybody giving up of themselves to fight for this greater cause, to punch Jerry in the face, as it were. I think it kind of speaks to the cultural differences between, like, Russia and the United States, because in Russia, even before we had the Bolshevik Revolution and the rise of communism, there was a lot more of a communal sense. And we still see it today in Russian culture, is you don't do things for yourself, you do things for everyone around you. Everybody rises, everybody falls. You do things for the community, as it were. And we've seen some interesting modern occurrences of backlash from this with, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The Russian version helplines actually tend to hinder more than anything. The audience will provide false answers because they feel that this person shouldn't be exceptional. It should be everybody who's winning, not just them. And I think the propagandists in the Soviet Union fed on that communal feeling, that culture of community.
Communalism over individuality.
Certainly. Maybe not as well as America did for our individual sense of patriotism, but I feel that what the Soviets did during the Second World War wouldn't have worked in America and vice versa because of cultural differences. But I definitely agree that in the end, we came out stronger for it, and I think definitely part of that was because we weren't asking to give up as much. It was the little things that did it, whereas in the Soviet Union, you were asked to give up everything.
It's also worth mentioning, perhaps, that the Soviet Union, Russia in general, was coming from a different historical and economic background than perhaps many of the other Western powers were, in that it had never really been considered historically a developed nation. It had always been considered kind of agrarian, backwater, kind of European, but not like one of the strong European nations like the others that were involved. And it went from that to being a power player within the span of that war.
Well, that's fair, but I mean, we see some cultural hallmarks between the two, between, like, Russia and the United States, because we had, a little later, because we had, like, the Gilded Age and stuff like that, right before the Depression, before the Bolshevik Revolution, we saw in Russia this aristocracy, and this those who have and those who do not, and that mirrors what happened in the late 20s and 30s in the United States, and somewhat similar stories, but very different outcomes.
Well, I'm going to say this, and maybe I'm going to show off my isolationist American upbringing in it, but to some degree, I think that same sense of absolute communalism, of everyone has the same, or if not the same, at the very least, we all share what we have, also in some sense gives rise, especially during a time of sacrifice like you were talking about, to that famous Russian despair, to that famous sense of angst and regret that permeates a certain place psychologically that we define as being distinctly Russian in some way. And I think that's a very poor motivator for people. The long-term impact of everybody sharing an incredibly heavy burden like that is not people who are motivated to then move on to conquering the next challenge. It's people who are left, perhaps maybe having gotten through the momentary crisis, but then what do you do afterwards?
Oh, certainly. And I mean, we do see this during the war. The Soviet Union famously had instituted for nearly the entire duration of the war a commissariat, which, for those of you listening, if you don't know what that is, it is a political organization that is there to enforce the party line, the political views of the ruling party, and to put down anyone who didn't toe the party line. If you turned your back on your country as it was, or you deserted, they felt you were no better than the enemy, and that only deepened this sort of dread and despair that Russia is kind of famously known for at this point, and in the United States and in Britain, and in Germany, they had a lot more subtle ways of dealing with dissent. You didn't see that as much. And of course, in Germany, you had the Gestapo, the secret police, that acted in a very similar way, but they weren't as present, I guess. They weren't as prominent as the commissars were. There was a commissar in every Soviet unit to, quote-unquote, keep morale up, as it were, whereas the Gestapo worked to get rid of political dissenters who were not necessarily combatants.
Well, but to be fair, the genius of a secret police force of any sort is this constant sense that they are just around the corner. They may not actually be, but you constantly are in fear of, have a sense that they are waiting for you around the next bend, whereas actually having to man and have somebody around every bend waiting for you is a much bigger undertaking. So the genius of it, I think, is that you can achieve that level of ubiquity of the sense of their presence without having to actually have it.
This allows them to punch a lot above their weight. You know, you've got the effective policing of 10 times their numbers because they're secret.
I found it works quite well.
I mean, it's the same theory that we use in giving tax audits, right? Mm-hmm. We essentially scare people with the threat of an audit, but most people will never be audited over the course of their lives because there are just not enough auditors. It would take us too much work. But by knowing that you never know when the audit is coming or who's going to get the audit, everybody gets the sense, I should watch out for the auditors, and it keeps you honest in that case.
Speed traps work on the same principle.
I think that actually brings us to a really interesting place in the conversation, which is to sort of turn the lens around and say, what do we have to say about this? Why philosophers, and why should we talk about propaganda, especially of the past when we have very little ability to influence the events that come before us. So what value can we add to that? And answering that question for myself, the answer is, looking back at these kinds of media that we involve ourselves with gives us an opportunity to prepare for the future, to look at those things that might come out ahead of us, to be more aware of the deeper meanings hidden within the things that we otherwise might just give a passing glance to. And the role of critical thinking and media literacy in understanding the world that we live in. Because these techniques have not stayed only in the theater of war. They've moved out into product placement and advertising and ways of manipulating political opinions, ways of having a dialogue. Those are all things that we can, by understanding more deeply what's come before us, look forward into the future and see the ways that those same lessons have been applied to other things.
I think when we look in international relations at who we should praise or who we should vilify for their actions, we need to have the concept of what would be a just war. In order to say that this action that this person's doing is unjust, would it be just to go to war against him? The only example I can ever think of a just war is World War II. Everything after that, it's depends on which side you're looking at. But even World War II, as we're seeing, is everyone telling themselves the same story of it on all sides. It is, by and large, a self-fulfilling, heroic prophecy. And yet, because everyone was fighting it out to the death of societies, it does strike me as a just war. Can any war be just that doesn't rise to that level? How do we answer those questions? Unless we compare them to this single benchmark, the one time when everyone going to war to fight and die was good.
Propaganda has stepped out of the theater of war, especially. And, I mean, if you think about it critically, it becomes very obvious over time, where you have this sort of push of media to influence the zeitgeist in what ostensibly the people who run our country want us to think, how they want us to have opinions. And I definitely agree with Sean here that it is very important to think critically about that stuff and to experience it. I have the good fortune of having traveled abroad and met people from different cultures than my own. It's similar. I've only ever been to Europe. I haven't gotten that far out of the cultural zeitgeist, as it were, because there are a lot of things shared. But you find out very quickly that the sort of propagandist view on the world, where we're right and everyone else is wrong, especially recently, doesn't really hold up. You find out very quickly that a lot of the people you run into are really similar to each other and to you. You kind of realize very quickly that we're all kind of the same. In a way, we all have similar goals and what we want to do. You know, we all kind of want to do what's best for ourselves. Method changes, of course, depending on where you are. But humans aren't all that different, even though there's a lot of propaganda, especially nowadays, and across the years, that would make you think otherwise. And that's where some of this isolationist mentality that we've had comes from. Is, well, they're different, so they must be wrong, or they're more different than we expect them to be when they really aren't. When you get down to the individual level, nobody's really all that different. Like, we have different opinions, but everybody has an opinion.
Whenever we think about different, you know, this society and that society, they want to fight each other, and they believe different things than we do, and we don't fit with each other, I sort of fall back on a basic belief that everyone, everywhere in the world, wants a bit of freedom, a bit of comfort, a bit of safety, and the hope that their children will do a little bit better than they did. And that's it. Everything else is just bullshit.
Bruce, silence. Sean, I grant unto you the last word.
I appreciate that, Professor. So I'm going to do something that we haven't done up to this point on the podcast, and I'm going to date when we're recording a little bit. This week in America, we've gone through a terrible national tragedy with what happened in South Carolina and the backlash of our attempt to wrap our heads around the terrible tragedy that went on there, and all of the bickering and all of the politicking and all of the back and forth about that topic. Since we're talking about World War II and propaganda, now seems like a particularly poignant time to talk about how those themes from our history impact our modern lives. And one of those ways is through events like what's going on right now in our country. It's hard to imagine very well-reasoned arguments for racism. It's very hard to imagine well-thought-out and civil positions for murder and hatred towards other people. Education, and specifically media literacy, the ability to understand what makes sense and what doesn't, and the common tricks that are used to sway people by emotion, are essential to preventing situations like this in the future. What is going on may not be completely preventable by just teaching people, because there will be some assholes out there no matter what else we do. But on some level, it's hard to imagine people being so easily swayed by the kind of ridiculous propagandist bullshit, not to sugarcoat it, that's being pumped out by some of these groups, if we really took the time to stop and teach our children how to understand what's being put in front of them, how to reason through the arguments that are being made by people, and how to understand the media firestorms that go on around these things. We as a country would see less of the sensationalist media attacks on things if we learned how to look through them, how to see what was really at the core of those kinds of arguments, and how to differentiate the things we should listen to from the things we shouldn't. This is exactly the kind of situation in which philosophy, as ancient and somewhat arbitrary as it seems at times, has a direct impact on our lives. The ability to do the critical thinking tasks necessary to hear arguments like white people are effectively being bred out of society, there is a white genocide going on. These kinds of arguments do not stand up to even the most scurrilous scrutiny. Even the most basic scouring of the surface of these topics would dispense them entirely. And yet, as a whole, we have not spent the time or energy to learn to look at those things properly to avoid them. And unfortunately, people are being swayed by those kinds of bad arguments and that kind of ill thinking. There will still be hatred in the world. There will still be troubles. All of those things will continue to exist. But we can minimize it. We can make it so hard to be a person like that if we just take the time to educate ourselves and to educate those around us. And this is one of the reasons that I have so strongly advocated for the education of critical thinking and philosophy in schools. We have cut this out of our curriculum in the favor of other things that are either on standardized tests or make more practical, technical sense in the job market. And we have lost a piece of our humanity for it. The ability to look at other people and understand their position, to empathize and to communicate with them, is essential to preventing these kinds of tragedies. We're not here to do politics. We're not here to talk about the other issues that this raises around gun control and symbolism and a lot of the other stuff that we all have to have a dialogue about in a very painful way, given the circumstances it's come up under. But what we can do, what we as intellectuals in this world can do, is try to make sure that we propagate that intellectualism and that attitude of open questioning towards all the things that come before us, and to teach those around us to do the same to these very, very poorly structured ideas that lead people into thinking that they have reason to fear for themselves when they don't, that lead to hatred. And these themes, these arguments, lead right back to World War II. We saw racism winning out, not just in Nazi Germany, but also in the American handling of the Japanese during World War II. We saw that same poor argument predicated on fear and mistrust of someone for no direct reason, but because of the color of their skin or the differences we saw between them, rather than a coming together of humanity, because it was valuable to use that kind of emotionally leveraging argument to move people in that direction. Not to look back at those propagandas, not to look back at those atrocities, is to lose the thread of what makes us human and how we can be better tomorrow than we are today. And that is why, in this climate of dealing with a terrible tragedy brought on by horrible racism, we need to refocus and look at the things that could have been done to save people's lives. Things that could have been done from a purely theoretical, purely intellectual level that required no bipartisan action, that required no movements of great powers in the world, that required only for us to desire to be better than we were yesterday and to help those around us be better. I hope that that message will mean something to you and that you will carry it into the world and pass it on to someone else who you care about so that the festering ideas that lead to these things don't get a foothold in us.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Don't forget to subscribe and review on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter. Send us your questions. And if you like what we're doing here, support us on Patreon. Join us next time after I have the propaganda team check their spelling. I've been your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Bruce.
I'm Sean.
I'm River.
All hail the glorious cousin land! Down with Bustralia!
I think that propaganda worked a little too well on Bruce.
Let's just stay away from him for the rest of the night and hope it wears off.
Yeah.
Security slash